So this talk will be essentially a completely different topic from my lecture later on in the week, and I'm going to talk about something which you might think is rather frivolous, but that's okay, I don't care. But also along the way, you know, we're going to explore some ideas that are quite serious and very, very useful. That's the idea anyway. And everything here will be really quite straightforward, in a sense. So here's a simple game for two players, which we call friendly frogs. You have a number of lily pads, points, in Euclidean space. And there are two players. The first player, Alice, places a frog on some lily pad of her choice. And then the second player, Bob, places a frog on a different lily pad. And then after that, they take it in turns to move, starting with Alice. And a move consists of moving either frog to a different lily pad. And there are two rules. The two frogs, they're friends, so they don't like to be moved further apart. So you have to move the two frogs closer to each other with your move. And a lily pad can't support two frogs, so they can't occupy the same lily pad. Okay, so those are the rules. And then it's a game, so we have to decide who wins. And the rule is, if you cannot move, if you have no legal move, then you lose the game, and the other player wins. So, for instance, you know, maybe Alice started here, and Bob started here, and now it's Alice's turn, so maybe she moves that frog to there, the two frogs are closer, and now it's Bob's turn, maybe he moves that frog to there, again they got closer, and now it's Alice's turn and she cannot move because you can't make them any closer than this, so that means Bob wins. Well, okay, could Alice have done any better? Could Alice have won? Well, let's think about it a little bit. So these two points, lily pads in the middle, the two that are closest together, if you ever move there, if you ever move the two frogs there, then the next player can't move, as we've seen. So, you know, this is a position you really want to move to, with the two frogs in the middle. So that means, okay, we can kind of work backwards. So that means you don't want to ever be in a position where one frog is on the middle pair and the other one is one of the other three, because then the other player can just move one of them to the other one of the middle pair. So really all we have to think about is these three outer points, the top left, top right, and the bottom one. So if we're just playing on those, you know, no player wants to move a frog to the middle pair. So if we're just playing on these three, then what do you want to do? Well, again, of these three, the top two are the closest, so it seems that's a good position to move to. And there's just one left over. So if Alice is smart, then she puts the first frog here, and then it's Bob's turn, maybe he goes here. And, okay, Alice, well, we don't want to move to these middle two, so Alice goes to there, that's moving the frogs closer, and now it's Bob's turn, and he has to move to one of the middle ones, then Alice moves there, so Alice wins. Okay. Well, who wins in general? Maybe a little bit surprising, it only depends on the number of points. So if you have any finite number of points, n in RD, say, and let's assume that all distances between pairs of points are distinct. You could relax that assumption, but for simplicity, let's assume that. With optimal play, Alice wins if the number of points is odd, Bob wins if the number of points is even. It's as simple as that. So why is this? Well, okay, so since the distance between the two frogs must decrease, the game can't last forever. So what we're going to do is, again, think about working backwards. We'll classify all two frog positions, where the two frogs are both in play, as either N positions, which means that the next player to move has a winning strategy, or P positions, which means that the other player, the previous player to wins, has a winning strategy. So really we just want to decide what these positions are. And, well, here's an algorithm, which is essentially what we did already. So consider every pair of points in turn in increasing distance. So start with the closest of the n-choose-2 pairs of points and consider all the pairs in increasing distance. And we're going to construct a matching. When we consider a pair of points, if neither point of the pair is matched, then we match them to each other. So here's the closest pair. We start by matching them. And now we only have three points left, so everything is everything is restricted to these three, and which is the closest pair, it's the top two, so when we get to consider them, they get matched, and in this case there's 1 point left over. And in general, there's only 1 point left over. And the claim is that the P positions, those are the positions that you want to move to, are precisely these red matching edges. And how do we prove that? Well, we really just have to prove from a P position, so again, this is a position you want to move to, your opponent cannot move to another P position. Well, that's easy. That just says from a matched pair, the next player cannot move to another matched pair. Well, that's clear because it's a matching. So from a P position, you can only move to an N position. And then we have to prove the other way around. From a non-matched pair, it's always possible to move to a matched pair. And why is that? Well, if you have a non-matched pair, why are they not matched? It's because when I considered all the pairs in order of increasing distance, at least one of them was already matched when I considered that pair. So that means one of the points is matched to a closer point, closer than the other guy of the pair. And that means if it's your move, you can move this right-hand frog to there, and then you're in a matched position. So from any N position, you can move to some P position. So that's the entirety of the proof. Not quite, because I only considered positions where there are two frogs, so now I need to consider the opening move. So remember, Alice places the first frog somewhere, Bob places a second frog somewhere else. Well, if N is even, then all points get matched in this red matching. So wherever Alice starts, Bob just puts the second frog on the partner of that point in the matching. And then he has a winning position. And if N is odd, then there's exactly one unmatched point, and Alice wins by putting the first frog there, because then Bob can't produce a matched pair. Okay, so that wasn't so difficult. But we're mathematicians, so we like to make things more difficult and perhaps less realistic. So what about infinite sets of points, infinite sets of lily pads? So is infinity odd or even for this purpose? Well, okay, not surprisingly, it depends. Now, one thing is, to begin with an infinite set of points, the game can easily go on forever. So if you have a sequence of points like this, with the distances between pairs decreasing, for example, then the game will last forever, because wherever the two frogs are, you can always leapfrog the left one just to the right of the right-hand one, and you move them closer together. You can always make such a move. So the game will never end. So these type of positions are very interesting, but I'm going to rule them out. I don't want to consider infinite games, so I'm going to assume that my set of points has no infinite descending chains, which simply means no sequence of points like this in which the distance between consecutive pairs is decreasing. Okay, but it still depends. So here's two easy examples. Suppose I have an infinite number of pairs of points that are very close together within the pair, but the pairs are reasonably well separated. Here, Bob wins very easily. Wherever Alice starts, Bob just puts a frog on the nearby point, the partner, and Alice can't do anything. Whereas if you have the same situation, but one of the pairs is not a pair, it's just a singleton, then Alice wins by putting the first frog here. Easy to see. So it depends. One thing you could ask is, what about a typical infinite set of points? Well, what does that even mean? If you're a probabilist, typical means random. So let's consider a random countable subset of RD as the set of lily pads. And, of course, the canonical choice of a random countable set in RD is the Poisson process, which I assume is familiar to almost everyone, but in case it's not, there are several ways you can define it. One is, take a big box of volume n and take n uniformly random points in the box, and then take an appropriate kind of limit as n goes to infinity. Another way is, you can divide space into boxes of volume epsilon and independently put a point in each box with probability epsilon, and then again take an appropriate limit as epsilon goes to zero. Or if you don't like limits, you can just say the number of points in a region has a Poisson distribution with mean the volume of the region, and disjoint sets have independent numbers of points. Okay, so that's the Poisson. This is very, very canonical meaning of an infinite countable set. So who wins? Well, first of all, you can show, it's not necessarily very interesting, but you can check that with probability 1, all distances are distinct in the Poisson processes. Every pair has a distinct distance, and there are no infinite descending chains. One can check that. So, okay, well, it's the same game. We need to identify the P positions, the positions that you want to move to. But we can't use the same algorithm as before because there's no closest pair of points. Distances between pairs of points are arbitrarily small in RD. So we need a kind of local version of the same algorithm. And here's something that works. We look for all mutually closest pairs of unmatched points. So what does that mean? We look simultaneously everywhere. We look for pairs of points that are mutually closest to each other. X is the closest point to Y, and Y is the closest point to X. And all such pairs, we match them simultaneously everywhere. And then we repeat. We ignore these points that are already matched, and we do the same thing with the unmatched points. So we look for all mutually closest pairs of unmatched points simultaneously everywhere, and we match them. And we repeat for an infinite number of steps, infinite but countable. Okay, so this gives you at least a partial matching of points. That's, for instance, what it looks like on a torus if you do this with random points. Okay, so I claim it's not just a partial matching. I claim all points get matched. So why is this? Well, consider the set of unmatched points U. So first of all, I want to claim there cannot be two or more unmatched points. So why is that? Well, so if U has at least size 2, then it must contain a mutually closest pair. And why is that? That's because there are no infinite descending chains. I actually have to use that, because you have a pair. Well, maybe they're not mutually closest. If they're not mutually closest, it's because one of them has a closer point. But then I could consider that pair, and one of them has a closer point. If I keep going forever, that's a descending chain, and that can't happen. So there is a mutually closest pair of unmatched points that never get matched in this infinite sequence of steps. Okay, but what does that mean? It means this region, the region of these two balls centered at the points, contains no other unmatched points. And that means after some stage of the algorithm, maybe the 20th step of the algorithm, that region contains no points, because there were only finitely many points in a bounded region to begin with. So why were they not matched to each other at the next stage of the algorithm? Because they're mutually closest. Okay, so that's that. That proves U can't be two or more. So now I want to prove U can't be of size 1. So there can't be exactly one unmatched point. If you think about this, there can't possibly be, because I started from a Poisson process on the whole of RD, and the Poisson process is translation invariant in distribution, and everything I did afterwards was deterministic. So I can't just end up with a random location in RD that has a translation invariant distribution. That's just not possible, but let's just see precisely how you could argue that, to show that there's nothing fishy here. You can divide space into unit cubes. You can let P be the probability that the unit cube contains an unmatched point, and then the probability that there is exactly one unmatched point somewhere is just, it's a disjoint union. It's the sum of all unit cubes of translated by integers, of course, of the probability that contains an unmatched point. And by translation invariance, all those probabilities are the same, so they're all P. If P is 0, then the probability on the left is 0, and if P is positive, it's infinity, so you can't have that. Okay, so that shows a very, very simple argument, nothing mysterious, but it shows you everything is matched. This is really this sort of the same argument as I gave before. Now I claim that the matched pairs in this matching are precisely the P positions, the two frog P positions. Well, again, if you're at a matched pair. No, again, I just have to check the two conditions. If you're in a P position, you cannot move to a P position. And if you're not in a P position, then you can. So if you're in a matched pair, then you cannot move to another matched pair, just because the matching is a matching. And if you're in a non-matched pair, then, okay, that means at least one of these points must be matched somewhere closer, because if not, if they're both matched further away, then which one gets matched first? Say this one. And then what's the argument? So why did these two get matched? These should have been a mutually closest unmatched pair. So why did these two get matched whenever they got matched in the argument? Okay, so what was the conclusion? One of these two must be matched to a closer point, and that means you can just move the other frog to there. So it's essentially the same argument as before. In a sense, infinity is even. So if you, for the Poisson process, friendly frogs is a win for Bob with probability one, because this matching is perfect, and so wherever Alice puts the first frog, Bob has to put the other frog precisely at the partner in this matching that I constructed. And then he wins. So let's pause for a minute. This was a very simple argument, but there's something slightly strange and subtle about it. So what properties of the Poisson process did we use here? I mean, we've seen there are some countable sets where Alice wins and there are some countable sets where Bob wins. And I just proved to you that with probability one, the Poisson process is one of the infinite sets of points that Bob wins. So, okay, well, what is it about the Poisson process? What probability one properties of the Poisson process did that use? I mean, I used all distances different and I used no descending chains, but there's more to it than that, because you can come up with sets of points with those properties where Alice wins. I mean, the ones I showed you before, for example. So is there a sort of a nice property that you could say the Poisson process has property P, almost surely, and property P guarantees that Bob wins? Well, I don't really know one. I mean, there are silly answers to this question. You can say P is the property that Bob wins, or you can say P is the property that this matching that I constructed matches all points. I mean, there's an answer to the letter of my question, but is there just a simple concrete property? I don't know one, and really this argument used invariance in a non-trivial way. It used the randomness and the invariance in a non-trivial way, even though it's very simple. I constructed this strange matching. Well, it's not so strange. It doesn't exist in a vacuum at all. There's another interpretation of it, which is very nice and very important. Let's imagine that each point has preferences. So not players, not frogs, points, lily pads. Each point, there's going to be a matching, and each point would prefer to be matched as close as possible. It's going to be matched to some other point, and it would prefer to be matched as close as possible. And we say that the matching is unstable if there is some pair of points that are not matched to each other, but would both prefer to be. Okay, so that means there's a pair of points that are not matched to each other, and their partners are both closer. I'm sorry, are both further away than the other one of the pair. So they would prefer to be matched to each other, but they're not. If that happens, I call it unstable. And there's an obvious interpretation, right? They prefer to be matched to each other, so that, why don't they go there instead? And if there are no such pairs, I call the matching stable. Okay, so effectively, this is the property that I checked when I was arguing about the game. So essentially, the proof I just showed you showed that our matching is stable. There's no pair of points like this, where they're not matched, but they're closer to each other than to their partners. And in fact, it's the unique stable matching that I constructed. Not too hard to show that. So this is a concept that goes back quite a way. There's a seminal paper of Gale and Shapley in 1962 about stable matching. This is where the concept originates. In the original version of the problem, it's a finite problem, and it's also bipartite, so they have n girls and n boys who are going to get married to each other, and they have arbitrary preference orders. So each girl has a permutation over the boys, which indicates her preference order. This is her favorite boy, this is her second favorite, and so on. And these can be arbitrary permutations, and also each boy has a preference order over the girls. And again, we set that, or they define a set of n heterosexual marriages is stable if there's no temptation of an affair. Essentially, there's no boy and girl that both prefer each other to the person that they are married to. And Galen and Shapley prove in this very, very nice paper that in this formulation of the problem, there always exists a stable set of marriages. It's very, very nice, and it's not obvious. So a couple of things that might indicate to you that it's not obvious. In this general setting, the stable set of marriages is not necessarily unique. Maybe multiple ones. And furthermore, it doesn't necessarily exist in the same-sex marriage version of the problem, which they called the roommates problem in 1962, where you just have two N people who are to be matched in pairs. But it turns out, in our case, we don't have arbitrary preferences, right? The preferences of our points were based on distance. You prefer to be matched as close as possible. So it turns out that in that setting, both of these are true. It is unique, and even in this one-color version, it is unique. It exists and is unique. And this was a highly influential paper by Gale and Shapley, and in fact, the 2012 Nobel Prize in Economics was awarded based on this work and the ensuing work. Actually, not to Gale and Shapley, but to Shapley and Roth. Shapley for this and other theoretical advances, and Roth for practical applications, of which there are many, of stable matching. Stable marriage. Let's back to the frogs. Let's ask a slightly different question. A variant of the game. Two-color friendly frogs. So before we just had two frogs, and on your move you could move either one. So now let's change it. Alice places an amber frog. Bob places a blue frog somewhere else, and then same rules as before. Take it in turns. Alice moves, then Bob, and the only difference is Alice is only allowed to move the amber frog. Bob is only allowed to move the blue frog. Makes sense. And again, the same rules. The two frogs must get closer, but they can't occupy the same point. And if you cannot move, you lose. Okay. So well. You might think we would just have to start again, figure out what are the NP positions and so on, come up with some iterative algorithm, but actually no, it's nicer than this. So let's consider the stable matching again. And this interpretation of preferences is very useful, because I'm going to say, so again, I have my set of points, this is the stable matching that I constructed. I'm going to say a point X desires a point Y if y is closer to x than the partner of x is. So this is a point that x would prefer to be matched to rather than what it's actually matched to. So, and note that it's a less than or equal to here, so you do actually desire your own partner, which is good. So for instance, this point here desires its own partner, but it also desires these two because they are closer than its own partner. Okay, so now the claim is, consider this two-color friendly frogs game. The claim is, suppose that the two frogs are at X and Y, and Y is the frog of the player who is to move next, then I claim this is a P position if and only if X desires Y. Not that they're matched anymore, but X desires Y. And again, this is a little bit confusing, but really checking it is just mechanical. You have to check. Okay, if X desires Y, then you cannot move Y to a place, a point Z that desires X. So why is that true? Well, Z would have to be closer to X and it has to desire X, but if Z is closer to X and X desires Y, then that means X also desires Z. So X and Z desire each other, and that actually implies that they are matched to each other. Otherwise they would be an unstable pair. So anyway, the So that's right. So how does X desire Y? Because X is matched to Z and it's perfectly happy. So why does it desire Y? Totally, it's a little bit confusing, but it's essentially mechanical to check. And then the other way around, you have to prove if X does not desire Y, then you can move Y to something that does desire X. And, well, you can just move it to the partner of X, because X does not desire Y, so that means it's matched to something that's closer than Y. That's its partner, and you can move Y there. Okay, so it's really just mechanical. Once you have the idea of what the P position should be, it's mechanical to check it. And in particular, every point is desired by its partner. So actually, this game is also a win for Bob on the Poisson process, because whatever point Alice chooses, well, Bob could just choose its partner again, because partners desire each other. And in fact, the two-color game and the one-color game share an optimal strategy. So that was a bit of a disappointment in the end, because it sounds like they're more or less the same game, but actually they're not. So here's one way that you can see that they're not. There's another variant, which we call shy friendly frogs. So let's say, try to give Alice a bit of a head start, because she's not doing very well at the moment. So the frogs are shy. They're friends, but they don't like to start out too close to each other. They like to get to know each other. So let's say that Bob's opening move must be at least distance 100 of Alice's opening move. And after that, same rules as before. Okay, well, the original one-color version, friendly frogs, is now shy friendly frogs, is a win for Alice. Why? Because, Alice just finds a point whose partner is closer than distance 100 in the matching and goes there, and then Bob can't go to the partner. But what about two-color friendly frogs? So shy two-color friendly frogs is again a win for Bob. So why is that? And this is all for the Poisson process. Every point is desired by infinitely many others. So that means wherever Alice goes to begin with, Bob can find a point that desires that point, and that's where his move is. Okay, so why is this? This seems very subtle and strange, but again, there's a very simple proof. Let's fix a point, so let's look at the closest point to the origin, just for definiteness, and suppose that point is only desired by finitely many others. So here's the point, here are some points of the matching. So now what I'm going to do is delete all points that desire W and their partners, except for W itself. Okay, so W is the partner of a point that desires W, so I don't delete that. So I delete all these other points from the process, and then think, what does the stable matching look like now? Well, all these points are gone, the ones that I deleted, and nothing else desires W. So all the other points that I haven't touched, it's irrelevant to them. They didn't desire W, they still match the to whoever they matched to before. But now W isn't desired by anybody, because I even deleted W's partner. That's kind of mean of me. But that means W is unmatched in the stable matching. So I deleted a finite number of points in such a way.
Yeah. Once you deleted, match to each other?
Yes, some of them. Because I deleted all points that desire W and their partners.
And their partners. Oh, I see.
Yes. Except for W itself. Yeah, I mean, this requires proof, right, of what I just said, but it's I hope, intuitive, and it's, you just have to sit down and prove it. It's reasonably straightforward. Now, this is a problem. The Poisson process, why is it a problem? Because of a subtle property of the Poisson process. Now I'm really using something. The Poisson process is deletion tolerant. What that means is if you delete a finite set of points of the Poisson process, even if you do it in a way that depends on the process, like I just did, you cannot cause a probability zero event to occur. So anything I get by deleting a finite number of points from a Poisson process still looks plausible as a configuration. Might look unlikely, but you can't say, no, that's definitely something that cannot happen in the Poisson process. And again, you have to prove that, but I hope it's kind of intuitive, because the Poisson process is just random points. You know, they could come anywhere. What happens to over here doesn't tell you anything about what happens over here. Strictly, the statement is that the law of the process I get by deleting is absolutely continuous with respect to the original one. And, well, that does it. I deleted finitely many points, and now a point is unmatched. But that's not allowed, because I proved before that every point is matched for stable matching of the Poisson process. Okay, so that does it. So again, it's a very short, simple arguments, but there's something somewhat deep going on here. Okay, yet another variant. And here there's going to be just another little idea. So let's have two colours of frogs and two colours of points. So also very, very natural variant. Let's take a Poisson process of points or lily pads again and give each one a colour. Each point, each lily pad is amber with probability alpha or blue with probability 1 minus alpha, independent choice for each point. And now, almost the same rules as before, Alice places an amber frog, Bob places a blue frog, I'm sorry, Bob places a blue frog. And same rules as before, except frogs may only occupy lily pads of their own colour. The amber frog can only go on amber lily pads, blue on blue. Otherwise, same rules, Alice moves the amber frog, Bob moves the blue, they must get closer, and if you can't move, you lose. Okay, well, it turns out stable matching comes to the rescue again. I won't go through all the details this time, but they're essentially the same as what I did before. The P positions can be characterized in terms of the unique two-color stable matching. So what's the two-color stable matching? It's a matching of points, but now it has to be just a matching of amber points to blue points. And maybe some people are unmatched. Maybe it's a partial matching. And it's stable in the sense that they do not exist. I mean, think of them as two genders, like in the original Gale-Chapley problem. There don't exist an amber and a blue point, which are not matched to each other, but would both prefer to be. Okay, that's the definition. And again, it turns out, similar algorithm, similar iterative algorithm, there is a unique, stable two-color matching. Now there are three possibilities. Either the stable matching is a perfect matching, it has all points matched, and then it turns out Bob wins. Similar argument to before, he just chooses the partner of Alice's pick. Or maybe it has unmatched blue points, or maybe it has unmatched amber points. And in the first case, Bob wins by choosing an unmatched blue point, for example. In the second case, or the third case, Alice wins by starting at an unmatched amber point. And you cannot have unmatched points of two colours simultaneously, because, well, if you have an unmatched amber point and an unmatched blue point, then they would prefer to be matched to each other. I should have said part of the definition of stable matching here is if you're not matched to anybody, you're extremely unhappy. So you would prefer to be matched to anybody rather than no one at all, as long as they're the right colour, the opposite colour from you. So these are the three possibilities. Theorem, but I haven't proved this yet, if alpha is greater than a half, Alice wins. If alpha is less than or equal to a half, then Bob wins, with probability 1. Why is this? Well, okay, first of all, the Poisson process, even with these added colours, is ergodic. under translations. So that means any translation invariant event must have probability 0 or 1. And each of these is a translation invariant event. The event that all points are matched, or the event that there exist unmatched amber points, is a translation invariant event. So they all have probability 1. So one of these three has probability 1 for any choice of the parameter alpha. Okay, when alpha equals 1/2, remember, what did I do? I started with points and I tossed coins for the points to decide whether they're amber or blue. So when alpha equals 1/2, the process of amber points looks the same as the process of blue points. So there's perfect symmetry between the two. So it simply could not be that there exist unmatched amber points with probability 1, for example, just by symmetry. So that case is taken care of when alpha equals 1/2. It's a perfect matching. Now, okay, when alpha is greater than 1/2, alpha is 3/4, 3/4 of the points are amber, so there are somehow more amber points around. So somehow, obviously, there must be some matched amber points, right? Because 3/4 of the points are amber, and it's a matching. But why? How do you actually prove this? I mean, you might think, okay, let's take a big box, a box of size 1,000,000, with high probability there are many, many more amber points than blue points in it. So how can I match them? Well, the only way is if lots of amber points get matched outside the box. So lots of them have to have very long edges matching to somewhere else. But, okay, why not? Why don't they? Maybe they do have long edges. Maybe they have very long edges. And somehow this has to be true on all scales simultaneously. So doesn't seem very likely that everything could be matched. But again, why? I mean, we have to use something about the random process here, because the amber points and the blue points are just two countable sets. They have the same cardinality, so there exist matchings between them, exist perfect matchings between them. So I have to use something else. And it turns out there's a very, very clean and powerful tool, powerful yet very simple tool, that lets us do this. And it's much simpler than all these things about considering big boxes that I was trying to think about. It's the mass transport principle is what it's called in general. So I'm going to imagine, this is just a picture, imagine sending mass 1 from every matched amber point to its blue partner. This is just a picture. Now I'm going to divide space into unit cubes again, and I'm going to say M of xy is the expected mass sent from the unit cube at x to the unit cube at y. X and y are elements of the integer lattice. Okay, that's just a function, it's just a number. It's like, you know, everything's fixed, it's a natural number, depending on x and y. Okay, so now I'm going to do something sneaky but completely elementary. The left-hand side here is the expected mass sent out of the unit cube at the origin, because it's the sum over all unit cubes in X of M 0 to X, the expected mass from 0 to X. Okay? And, okay, well, the whole process is translation invariant, so the expected mass sent from 0 to X is the same as the expected mass sent from minus X to 0. Because I just translated these two boxes like this. So we have this. And now, okay, I'm summing over minus x in ZD, but that's just the same as summing over x, of course. And on the right-hand side, I have the expected mass into the unit cube at the origin. So expected mass in equals expected mass out. And, well, that's all I need. This is the expected number of matched amber points in the unit cube, because again the rule is you send mass 1 if you're a matched amber point to your partner, and this is the expected number of matched blue points in the unit cube. Well, certainly that's less than or equal to the expected total number of points in the cube on both sides, and that's just alpha, because I had a Poisson process of intensity 1, and then I selected points with probability alpha, and this is 1 minus alpha. So if I was assuming that alpha was bigger than 1 minus alpha, and these two are equal, so that means this has to be a strict inequality. So that means the expected number of amber points in the cube is greater than the expected number of matched amber points in the cube. So that means there must be, with positive probability, there must be unmatched amber points in the cube. But then, yeah.
You can also do it more elemental, right? You know, if you have a constellation invariant matching, then you have a distribution for the distance. So there's going to be some distance, so it's 90% probability. You think they're going to be less than this distance, and then you can do your counting over big boxes and so on and so forth.
I wouldn't call that more elementary personally, but.
You're doing something similar, right? But it's like.
Yes, but there's no big boxes needed. I mean, there's no limits. This was, no matter how you look at it, a very, very simple argument, but this mass transport principle is extremely useful. It's a very simple tool, but using it in the right way, you can get all sorts of highly non-trivial things. So that was that. So lest you think that everything here is analyzable, let me show you an open problem. Fussy frogs. So let's go back to having. Let's go back to a Poisson process again, and this time each lily pad is red with probability p or green with probability 1 minus p, because they're just Poisson points. And now I have two frogs again, not two colours of frogs, just two frogs. And the rules are exactly the same as before, exactly the same as the rules for friendly frogs, except. Now, you're not allowed to have both frogs on red. That's the rule. But other than that, they have to get closer together, and if you cannot move, you lose. So there's a matching associated with this as well. It's the stable matching under the restriction that you're not allowed to match two red points to each other. You can make sense of that. For p greater than or equal to half, turns out there are unmatched red points, and that means Alice wins. So is there any p for which Bob wins? This is an open problem. We believe not, I would say. But yeah, and it's not known in any dimension. So, finally. Right. We have something in preparation about high dimension, but it's kind of. We believe the answer to this is no. In high dimension, we can prove that Alice wins in a rather weak sense. That if you fix the p, then there is some dimension high enough where Alice wins. It's really very weak. So one final folly. K pond friendly frogs. So let's suppose we have K ponds. Each one is a copy of RD. I think of them as like disjoint copies of RD. And each one has its own Poisson process of lily pads. And each pond is going to have two frogs on it. And then when it's your turn, you can move one frog in any one pond according to the same rules as before. The two frogs in that pond must get closer, and you lose if you don't have any available moves in any of the ponds. Okay, this is a special case of a general concept in combinatorial game theory. Called the disjunctive sum of games, k copies of friendly frogs in this case. Bob is doing rather well. So Bob wins even if, so I didn't quite say what happened with the opening moves. Bob wins even if we let Alice place two frogs in each of the ponds except for the last one, wherever she wants, and then she can place one frog in the last pond as well, and then it's Bob's turn to place the last frog, and then Alice goes next as usual. So even in that situation, Bob wins. And this, how is this proved? So it, well, it comes from the existing theory of impartial games, Sprague-Grundy values for impartial games, but it turns out in this case the theory just fits beautifully with what happens on the Poisson process. So here's how you do it. So at least I'll tell you how Bob chooses his move. In each pawn separately, I'm going to assign every pair of points an edge labelled with a non-negative integer. And how do I get these integers? I'm going to say each point looks at the closest point that it does not yet have an edge to. It's just a definition. And then, so it's similar to before, pairs that are looking at each other mutually get assigned an edge labelled with a number. And what's the number? It's the smallest number that neither of them has yet on one of its incident edges. Okay, so it's just some rule, some algorithm. And again, you repeat this for infinite, countably many rounds. So, like, maybe these pairs get a 0, and then these get a 1. So it's just some rule. You end up with a... and it turns out the value is the minimum excluded value of the positions you can move to from that edge. Well, you can show, for the Poisson process, with probability 1, every pair of points gets an edge. And furthermore, the edges that are emanating from a vertex x are precisely labelled with the non-negative integers, 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. So, okay, here, now I'll tell you Bob's opening move, and this comes from the general theory, but if you haven't seen it before, it's quite remarkable. Here are the pawns with two frogs in each, except for the last one, and Bob is trying to decide where to put his frog. So you look at each of these edges in the first k-1 pawns. Each one has got labelled with an integer by this process, and you write those integers in binary, 101, 011, and you take the bitwise XOR of them. That gives you another number in binary, and that gives you an integer, and you find the unique edge emanating from this frog that is labelled with that number 6. And that's where Bob has to place his additional frog. And again, you know, let me emphasise, this technique is standard and well known amongst combinatorial game theorists, but you know, how you would ever guess that that's what you have to do would be very difficult. But once you have that guess, really it's just mechanical, the process of checking that it works. You know, you have P positions and N positions, and you just have to check that the conditions hold, and it's not difficult at all. Okay, so I'm going to stop there, and there's a bunch of references. Essentially, everything I've said here is in this paper on the archive in essentially the same form. We sort of wrote it as a kind of a pedagogical paper, so the idea is to introduce these ideas as we go along. If you take one thing away from this talk, I highly recommend going to read this paper of Gale and Chapley from 1962. So it's very short, it's only 10 pages or something. It's beautifully written with nice little counterexamples and so on. And as I said, it's had amazing influence. I think there may be thousands of citations. Really important paper. If you want to know more about matchings on the Poisson process, there's this paper. And if you want to know more about combinatorial games, well, one place to start is this series of books, Winning Ways. And that's it. Yes. Yes.
So you're dealing with infinite sums here.
Yes.
How do you know that they're convergent?
You don't necessarily. They're non-negative. They could be infinite. Yeah, but they're non-negative. Yeah, it's a very good point. No, the way I defined it, this is non-negative. You send. And again, you have to yeah, you have to look at the definition carefully to see that it's non-negative. You send mass 1 from an amber point to a blue point, and this is the mxy is the expected mass sent from this cube to this cube. So it's non-negative. Yeah, a priori it could well be infinite. I mean, in this case it's not because of this bit. Right? But yeah. Infinity is allowed in general, and you know, actually many more serious applications of the mass transport principle end up with a contradiction of the form infinity on one side and something finite on the other side, in fact. Of course, if you wanted, you could make them, you could allow them to be negative, but then they'd have to be integrable. Good, yes. You can, it's a very interesting question to, for example, take amber and blue points, point processes, and ask about the cost of the matching between them. So the average length or a typical length of an edge of the matching, essentially. And yes, there are many interesting things to be done. In particular, you could ask, well, there are many matchings, right? I mean, you could ask about general translation invariant matchings, what's the optimal cost? And you can also ask about the stable matching. So we have this paper that I showed you at the end. We have bounds on what happens for the stable matching. So, for example, if you take two color matchings, then it's strongly dependent on the dimension. So first of all, these edge lengths have heavy tails, so it's not really, it's not necessarily the right thing to ask about the average length, the expectation. Something that makes more sense is to say, for a typical point, what is the tail behavior of the length of its matching edge? Now, in, for example, for two colors, the answer is, this random variable, the random edge length, has infinite half moment, infinite one half moment, so it's heavy tailed, and finite moments below that for the stable matching. And in one dimension, any matching is like that. So in one dimension, at least up to this crude level of tail behavior, stable matching is as good as anything. In three and higher dimensions, it's definitely not. In three and higher dimensions, the stable matching still has power law tails, but there exist matchings with exponential tails. And in two dimensions, we don't quite know. The stable matching does have power law tails, and the optimal matching has power law tails, but we don't actually know whether the powers are the same or not. What I mean by optimal is, well, in two dimensions, every translation invariant two-color matching has infinite expectation and that's, you know, more or less tight up to the level of the power. So, whereas the and there so again, every matching has infinite expectation, and there exist matchings that have, you know, finite 0.99 moment. The stable matching, we have power law upper bounds of that sort, so some moment is finite, some is infinite, but we don't actually, you know, they're far apart, so we don't know whether it's as good as the optimal one at the level of the power. So we don't know. So we, in other words, we don't know whether the stable matching has finite 1 minus epsilon moment in two dimensions. Yeah, sorry for the long-winded way to get to a very simple statement.